Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and welcome to the first of two planned episodes covering Target Book Number 111 and Episode 110 of Doctor Who Literature, covering the novelization of The Celestial Toymaker, published in November 1986. We are going to need two episodes to talk about this book, for the very good reason that a sequel to The Celestial Toymaker recently aired as Doctor Who's final David Tennant and first Shuti Gatwa episode. It's called The Giggle, the novelization of which was released earlier in 2024 in the UK and only very, very, very recently in the US. I do have a guest lined up to talk about Celestial Toymaker, the 1966 TV episode, and its very troubled genesis and production. But, of course, this is a weekly podcast, and that schedule does not always adhere rigidly to people's real-life timetables. And the guest that I'm hoping to bring you to talk about The Celestial Toymaker on TV is not yet available. So I will put that episode on the back burner for the immediate future. It will come to you as soon as we can get it. But I am very happy to announce that we do have the author of the novelization of The Giggle. James Goss is on Doctor Who Literature for the first time, hopefully not the last. We are going to have one of the longest conversations that I've ever presented on this show, but it is absolutely worth every second, and I did edit out some material. James is an absolute force of nature to interview. This conversation may not be suitable for children under the age of 10. We do talk a lot about some pretty heavy topics at times. We talk about 9/11. There's some issues of biblical interpretation. However, this is just an absolutely amazing chat, and I'm pleased to bring it to you, after which I will present my review of Celestial Toymaker, the 1986 novelization of the 1966 TV story. Trap One, the other podcast to which I am a contributor, recently discussed the novelization of The Giggle and also had James on as a guest, so I heartily recommend you listen to that one after you listen to this one. There is some other news. I am going to keep that very short, of course, so that we can get to the interview and the rest of the episode. I recently hit a subscription milestone on YouTube, but I'm always looking for more subscribers. You can find us on YouTube at Doctor Who Novels. That's at Dr. Who Novels. Please subscribe. Get push notifications for all of our episodes, which come out every Sunday. Also got an email from Shannon Patrick Sullivan of the Brief History of Time Travel website, which is one of the indispensable sites on this podcast, a great repository for finding out production details of Doctor Who episodes from the 1960s all the way up to the end of the show's original classic series run in 1989. Happy to hear that Shannon is a listener to the program, and Shannon was very pleased with last week's 8-minute-long baseball editorial talking about the 1986 World Series. He writes, "Great cold open to the Harry Sullivan's War podcast. Their encapsulation of the 86 World Series was great." I also want to give a shout-out to James Kure Smith, who continues to kill it with his newsletter, Psychic Paper. This week he had an article about a Doctor Who production equally fraught to The Celestial Toymaker. That was the making of the Trial of a Time Lord season and the behind-the-scenes tsuris that ushered Colin Baker out of the role and saw John Nathan Turner treated perhaps very, very unfairly by the powers that be at the BBC. I will include links to all of this in the show notes. But now, without further ado, James Goss, Celestial Toymaker, The Giggle. Let's get to it.
They all say, who is Doctor?
This is Tim Treloar.
This is David J. Howe.
I'm Peter Purvis.
I am Sadie Miller.
This is Lauren Cornelius.
Larry, it's Fraser.
for all things in the Doctor Who collecting world and beyond. The Doctor Who Collectors Podcast. I'm Larry Van Mersbergen, your host, and I've been collecting for 42 years. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature on the Direction Point Podcast Network. Keep turning the pages.
I am thrilled to announce that my next guest joining me today is James Goss. James, welcome to Doctor Who Literature.
Hello. It's lovely to be here.
I was going through your list of credentials and accomplishments in preparation for this recording, and I am embarrassed to admit that you are younger than I am, so I should start off by saying that I hate you. However,
I love that I'm younger than somebody. I'm not younger than nearly anybody anymore.
Being from the 1970s used to be with it and shiny, but now we are rapidly approaching, not obsolescence, but we are rapidly approaching Grandpa Simpson old man territory.
I love that I'm arranging to have a birthday party with a friend this year, and I've realized it will be our joint 99th birthday party, which is the point at which you just go, oh no.
Yeah, if you add up any time that I've been invited to a friend's 50th, we now have 100 years between us. So welcome to the Century Club soon enough.
Yes, life is horrible. I still remember being a bouncy young 20-year-old, and it seems unfair that that is no longer the case.
Well, we can still be bouncy. We just don't bounce quite as high.
Yes, and then we need to sit down afterwards.
For quite some time. Luckily, we're doing this conversation from nice, comfy chairs, so to speak. Yes. You began work on the Doctor Who website in the year 2000. You have since graduated to writing several short stories, novels, Big Finish work, plays, a multitude of other things. And I also see that you did work on Buffy the Vampire Slayer for the BBC website, as well as producing some Dark Shadows audios at Big Finish. And those are the two shows that I am currently watching my way through right now in order. One with my daughter, one by myself. You can guess which is which.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot to talk about even without getting to Doctor Who, but as this is primarily a Doctor Who show, I'm going to get right to our favorite Time Lord in various incarnations. What is your Doctor Who origin story? What's the first episode you can remember watching? When did you become a fan?
The first episode I can remember watching, and it took me a while to realize it was actually Doctor Who I was watching, but I remember seeing the very end of The Androids of Tara and being very sad about the dog. And I was hoping that they would show us the dog being rescued, but they never did. So that made me sad.
And then the following 4 weeks is The Power of Krull, where K-9 does not appear at all. So you would have been in suspense for about 6 weeks of real time.
Not really. Partly, I think it must have been because I think Androids of Tara got a summer repeat, which would have made no sense to anyone. But also, at the time, I was only watching Doctor Who because I was really waiting for Basil Brush. For Americans, I should explain, Basil Brush was a very popular Fox puppet who was very rude, and his catchphrase was "Boom Boom." Everyone was obsessed with Basil Brush back in the 1970s because not much else happened.
I can tell you that I know of Basil Brush because there were a couple of clips shown as special features on the various Doctor Who DVDs over the years, but I don't have firsthand knowledge. When did Doctor Who overtake Basil Brush as your TV viewing of choice?
I was asked this the other week, and I think it was the Five Faces of Doctor Who repeat season, which again, for Americans, when Legopolis happened, and, you know, young me was just like, oh, Doctor Who fell off a tower. This is sad. John Nathan Turner then followed it with this incredible repeat season that ran for weeks up until the reintroduction of Peter Davison. And that was a repeat season of The Unearthly Child, The Crotons, Carnival of Monsters, The Three Doctors, and Legopolis. So basically everybody got a crash course in fandom, which I think was possibly one of the most genius and exciting things that John Nathan Turner ever did. Because it meant that when Peter Davison turned up on screen, everyone was suddenly, all these 6, 7, and 8 year olds were all suddenly fan aware. Which is an incredible place to place your audience in. But he did it, and that was great.
So over a course of 5 weeks, you got to see every one of the first five Doctors, including the brief Peter Davison cameo at the very end of Legopolis.
Exactly.
I will say that patients already on the show, and most of my guests from the UK all come back to that same origin point, the five faces of Doctor Who. So that has to have been a signal event that I'm sorry I missed.
Yeah, it was terribly exciting because you had no idea what was coming next. Because imagine if the last episode of Doctor Who you'd seen was Legopolis, and you didn't even know what Legopolis was, but you were quite sad because Nice Hairy Man fell. And then the next thing you watch is in black and white with Arsehole. then followed by three episodes of Cavemen, and you're just going, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen. And just when you think you've actually understood it, what is the cat's name, please? Just when you think you've actually understood it, along comes the Patrick Troughton. Hello, Smudge. So you get all of this glorious madness. And then, you know, you suddenly have to get your head around John Pertwee being Doctor Who, which, you know, especially the idea that there's a story that existed which featured William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee, which just seemed insane. And I would like to imagine that it was during the repeat of the Five Faces of Doctor Who that John Nathan Turner went, I'm going to do the Five Doctors. Nothing will stop me from doing the Five Doctors. I think that Five Faces of Doctor Who was incredibly influential, especially because, you know, in terms of it being a crash course in fandom, I think the show itself also changed as a result of the Five Faces of Doctor Who, because all of a sudden, Doctor Who stories were much more influenced by those repeats in a way that you can't really quite put your finger on. But suddenly Time Lords are mentioned a lot. Regeneration is mentioned a lot. The idea that there are time streams, it's essentially like those five stories that were picked for the repeat season sort of focused what Doctor Who was going to be going on, even though the Peter Davison era is very, very different. Suddenly Time Lords are mentioned a lot. Gallifrey is mentioned a lot. Regeneration is mentioned a lot. Previous monsters are mentioned a lot. So I think that repeat season, generally, it changed the audience and it changed the show. So there we go.
And then, of course, you have season 20, where every story is a sequel, including a sequel to The Three Doctors, although the lore has changed so much that it's hard to draw a straight line between Three Doctors and Ark of Infinity. But it is there. There's Omega once again.
Yeah, it is mad to think that Ark of Infinity and The Five Doctors are in the same season. I remember during my youth, my long ago youth, I decided to be an Ark of Infinity truther, and I decided once I'd finally seen the Ark of Infinity that it was good. And sometimes an episode of New Who will go out and you'll go, do you know what? That's not the best. But you will see young fans on Twitter going, that is the best story I've ever seen. And you'll sit there and as a jaded old fan, you'll go, do you know what? You're wrong. But then you remember that when you were young and you were just like, do you know what? Ark of Infinity is just gorgeous. It's great. I don't understand why people bang on about Snake Dance. So I think it happens to all of us that we just pick a story from Doctor Who as we grow up and just go, that one is the best. And now, of course, you watch it and you just go, it's about two gays on a gap year. And they're annoying. And their annoying fag hag cousin who turns up and discovers that one of them's been kidnapped by a chicken. Which, you know, we've all been to Amsterdam and been kidnapped by a chicken, but for very, very different reasons. The whole thing, the whole of Ark of Infinity, it's all insane. But there you go. And then you get the Five Doctors at the end of the season, which is possibly one of the most competent Doctor Who stories ever made. Don't fight me.
Ark of Infinity was my first story. My first cliffhanger was part two of Ark of Infinity. So that was a story that lured me into fandom, first of all. And then Five Doctors videotaped that, and I watched it over and over again. Not the fact that my VR cut out 5 minutes before the end of Five Doctors. So the last thing I saw for years was Barusa putting on the ring, and I had no idea what happened after that. But everything else before that was wonderful.
I also love the fact that, you know, just as a sign of how not necessarily competent Doctor Who was as a whole, the Five Doctors is in many ways a sequel to the Arc of Infinity and features loads of callbacks to the Arc of Infinity that don't work. So you've got the character who goes, the Doctor wants revenge. And you're going, you were in the Five Doctors? You were in Arc of Infinity? Were you in Arc of Infinity? Are you absolutely sure? And Blue Barusa is clearly supposed to be the same Barusa, but it's clearly not the same Barusa. And also, if it was the same Barusa, he'd just be like, oh, now the last time somebody got obsessed with immortality, it ended very badly for him. So why am I doing this? And Chancellor Thalia has become Chancellor Flavia. You know, it's an absolute mess of a sequel to Arc of Infinity. And you sort of wonder why they bothered. But at the same time, you don't really care because it's the most exciting Doctor Who story that's ever been made.
If Arc of Infinity had revolved around the playing of a harp, it would have possibly been a much better story, because that harp is an important plot point in Five Doctors.
Yeah. And, you know, you could have had a callback to that. Similarly, the whole idea that suddenly it also has to be a sequel to Mordred Undead. You know, it's a show that is not necessarily quite used to... it's able to call back to itself, and it's doing it very, very fluently. But like me, when I try and speak a foreign language, it's doing it with confidence, but not competence. So the joyousness of it having to accept that the Brigadier's now got his memory back, having been hiding in a boys' school for 20 years. Therefore, he turns up to his reunion for a job that he's forgotten he had. And nobody goes, what are you doing here?
I think a more important question is, how do you prefer your Nicholas Courtney? With mustache, a la Five Doctors, or without mustache, a la the 1983 half of Mordred Undead?
Oh, I think he looks very distinguished in the Five Doctors. And Nicholas Courtney's lack of mustache in Mordred Undead is not the problem with Mordred Undead.
Did you remain a fan of Doctor Who throughout the rest of the 80s, all the way up until Survival in 1989?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was around about the time where you could, if you ventured vaguely into fandom, you ended up reading episodes, issues of Doctor Who Bulletin, which is the most poisonous fanzine that ever existed. And, you know, it was like having a sneery 14-year-old following you around, which, you know, even when you weren't 14, was just horrible. And you couldn't avoid it. Like, when the telestaps of the Power of the Daleks were discovered and you sent off for the Power of the Daleks photo novel, along with it came several free issues of Doctor Who Bulletin full of really vile, horrible, weird, snide stuff. So, yeah, it was a very, very strange period where, you know, as a child, you were just going, I love Doctor Who. There's so much Doctor Who. And then this magazine turns up going, everything is awful. You need to hate everything. I almost wonder if there's sort of the petering out period of Doctor Who was partly helped by Doctor Who Bulletin, which had such an agenda against a man who we now realize was forced to carry on making Doctor Who almost at gunpoint. Whilst the fans were just screaming for his blood all the time. And, you know, it's a very, thank God Twitter didn't exist back then.
I think Twitter existing now is one of the worst reasons to be alive in the 21st century. And I say this having deleted my Twitter account 3 months ago, arguably a couple of years too late, but I'm so much happier off of it.
Oh no, which means that you left Twitter before the immortal pussy in bio phase. I look at Twitter very little recently, and underneath every post is the nudes in bio, and I'm just like, oh, it's so weird, all these lonely sexy women barking very loudly up the wrong tree all over Twitter. I don't understand. I just, there you go. I'm a crazy old man who doesn't like Twitter. Yeah, that's not really a reactionary point. But could you imagine who would have been the first Doctor Who producer who would have been driven insane by Twitter? I'm sure Verity Lambert would have just been very aloof about the whole thing. And keeping on slapping David Whittaker and going, David, get off there. Get off there at once. whilst David Whittaker is puffing a pipe and going, I think they've got it absolutely wrong about the planet Marinus. I don't know. I mean, I think John Wiles would have had one of those sort of like 2 a.m. drunken tweeting rages where he's just like, it's not my fault. I got all these stories and I don't want to do it. I just want to do things about mystical beings in their underwear. And it would have all ended horribly, horribly wrong. I think, you know, the Troughton era ones and Barry Letts and Terence Dix would have, oh my God, Barry Letts and Terence Dix would have done lots of Ask Me Anythings on Reddit and would have become absolute legends. And then I think Philip Hinchcliffe would have been discovered to be running his own parody Philip Hinchcliffe account.
I think the ongoing war between John Wiles, Donald Tosh on the one hand and William Hartnell on the other would have played out much differently on Twitter, and you would have seen Hartnell out of the role much, much faster, because Tosh spent years telling these stories about Hartnell that are of questionable truth value. But if he was on Twitter spreading them in the 1960s, you might have actually seen Hartnell leave forever during Celestial Toymaker rather than coming back for the next four or five series.
Or Hartnell would have moved on to TikTok and would have become a quite surprising TikTok star. Possibly doing recipes.
The photo of Hartnell in a bathing suit in Space Museum Episode 2 is quite possibly the first nudes in bio in Doctor Who history.
Oh my God. Absolutely wonderful. Yes. Oh my God. It's Doctor Who's first thirst trap. You are amazing, Jason.
So the wilderness years hit.
Felt cute, and might delete later.
One of the great things in the Giggle novelization, which I promise we're coming to, is you worked on a reference to the Third Doctor, past Doctor adventure, Devil Goblins from Neptune. I assume during the wilderness years, you were collecting all the books as they came out.
Yeah, I've got, I think, most of the Virgin ones. And then, for some reason, all of the BBC books. The mad thing about the BBC books is, and this is not decrying them as a range, but whereas I can remember every story of the Virgin New Adventures because they meant so much to me, and I know I've read all of the BBC books, I can remember about three of them, which is, you know, which is very strange. I think because they all had like a really high punchy level of quality, but they're all very, very interested in alternative dimensions and that kind of thing. They've sort of all merged into this sort of fond golden memory. But it's a very hazy memory. Whereas the Virgin ones, because they were all so disparate and mad and wild and endlessly creative, you know, you can remember the Virgin ones. You know, nobody has ever mistaken so vile a sin for damaged goods. Nobody has ever misremembered Timeworm Revelation as the pit. You know, everyone has these incredible memories of the Virgin ones. Whereas the BBC books range, they were just like this ongoing soap opera of genuine competence and just creative joy that you're just like, oh, I can't really remember that one. I think that's the one where the TARDIS lands in a sea of other TARDISes on an infinite desert. And you go, no, I can't remember which one that is, which is a real shame because, you know, it's sort of like this glorious pudding of goodness that is very hard to... I mean, do you have a favorite BBC book? Books?
For selfish reasons, Vampire Science, because I kind of sort of appear in it as a peripheral character. Although if you ask every Doctor Who fan in a room which one is their favorite, you're not going to get a lot of Vampire Science as the answer because it was one of the first ones. But The Lost Student Vampire was kind of sort of based on me, and we share 2/3 of our name.
Oh, I mean, I remember Vampire Science, and I remember Illegal Alien. And then there's sort of, you know, just many, many years of just being really glad those books existed.
I got my first New Adventures in 1991 at the age of 18. and there wasn't a lot of competition. You had Star Trek The Next Generation going on. That was right around the time that Spock came back for a two-part episode, of which he's only really in one of the two parts. But the New Adventures were my primary source of entertainment for the next 6 or 7 years. Buffy comes to American TV in 1997. In the year 2000, somebody posts, I think on Rekar's Doctor Who, what do you want to see in the EDAs to improve them? And I said, make them more like Buffy, you know, with more emotional resonance and an ongoing story arc book to book, rather than just, you know, random things happening in no particular order. Well, I got my wish, but then the story arcs in the EDAs became so convoluted that I was able to follow the Trapped on Earth. I was able to follow when McGann gets his TARDIS back, but doesn't get his memory back. And then by the time you get to the alternate universe cycle on the Council of Eight, I was kind of confused. And after Sometime Never, I didn't even read all of the books in between Sometime Never and Gallifrey Chronicles. So there is a gap in my EDA knowledge. And also at that point, there's more competition. There's more quality TV. We're already into Buffy and The Sopranos. And of course, when I'm 32, 33, my book buying habits are not quite what they were at age 18. I blame myself more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you've conjured up a whole lot of, you know, I have all these. Skeletons made of glass and all these gorgeous images, but there's also this sort of like fuzziness as to what was actually going on. And I remember that there was a villain who had a name, and the name's gone, but he would keep on turning up, and he was sort of like Brian Blessed. Yeah.
I think we're talking about Sabbath, if memory serves me
right. Oh, yes, that's it. Yes. And he was sort of a villain, but not a villain.
I was on another podcast last year covering the books, We're All Stories in the End, and I was the guest of the month for Camera Obscura, which I had not read in about 20 years.
Oh, that was a good one. That was a really good one.
It held up really well. In fact, I understood the Sabbath arc a lot better in 2023 rereading the book than I did the first time around.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that there was a point at which the big reveal at some point was going to be that he was working for the Daleks but planning on betraying the Daleks, but then it turned out no, they just couldn't renegotiate the rights of the Daleks, so no Daleks. I think there is a giant mystical sink plunger that appears in a hologram at one point in one of the books, which is as near as they get to it, and you're kind of like, yeah, that was a fascinating period where yeah, they all start, because those books, when they first started out, we were all just so mourning the loss of the Virgin license that we couldn't forgive those books for being good. And when they got good, we sort of couldn't forgive them, because we're like, too little, too late. Virgin would have done this better. And the answer was BBC Books were actually doing it really very well. And also BBC Books really gave us Christopher Bulis, which is, you know, the whole, Christopher Bulis, who would deliver a book whether you wanted the book or not. And I also remember that there was an author whose name I have completely forgotten. He wrote a book called Rags and Combat Rock.
Mickey Lewis, who's been on this show. Mickey Lewis.
Right. Because I remember them just being like very, oh God. Oh wow. You know, Agony fisted the Doctor, and you go, oh gosh.
I bought Combat Rock in August 2001 at a bookstore at the World Trade Center, which 2 weeks later became a graveyard. If there's any book you're going to buy in a graveyard, Rags is the one to buy. It was an unfortunate harbinger of things to come.
Good God. Wow. I remember when that happened, we were filming TARDIS Cam at the BBC Model Studio. And when it all happened, one of the buildings fell down on the BBC's emergency generator, which was what was serving BBC websites in America. And so we all then spent the next week waiting for the emergency generator to run out of power, at which point the BBC would go down online in America, which we were all very kind of like, oh, this feels symbolic of something. But yes, I do remember the deep strangeness of we were filming things exploding in a model studio, and then at lunchtime we watched the planes fly into the World Trade Center, which was very strange. Also, watching a building explode with a lot of people whose livelihoods were making buildings explode and getting them to stand there and go, oh, it does that. Oh, that's really interesting. And you're there going, I want to find a room and cry. But I'm surrounded by a lot of people who, you know, kind of like watching a Formula One car crash when you're a car mechanic, just go, oh, that is really interesting.
Oh, I can also tell you from memory that the first three DVDs to come out on the States, so The Five Doctors, Spearhead from Space, Robots of Death, were released on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. So getting my Amazon delivery on that day was almost cognitive dissonance, and I didn't get to them for about a week. Although watching Spearhead from Space helped me heal emotionally because it gave me a safe place to go to in the middle of all the living in the New York area, in the middle of all the angst.
Yeah, that was a really weird time, which it's really, I mean, in some ways, it's really, really cool that people can be in their early 20s and have absolutely no memory of 9/11. Whereas the rest of us, you know, are sort of informed by everything that's going on at the moment in the world, is sort of informed by the fact that we all went absolutely fucking nuts after September the 11th. You know, I remember all the madness of things like even French fries became renamed Freedom Fries. All of the absolute insanity of a world gone absolutely potty when the red mist descended.
During World War One, Americans no longer ate sauerkraut, but renamed it Liberty Cabbage.
Oh, my God. That is such a RuPaul's Drag Race. Please welcome to the stage, Liberty Cabbage.
There was actually a baseball player named Germany Schaefer around World War One who changed his name to Liberty Schaefer for that exact reason. Although Liberty Cabbage is a much better drag name than Liberty Schaefer, I'll say that much.
Wow. Wow. This conversation is going to continue in my WhatsApp group later. Liberty Cabbage.
Moving on to slightly happier tidings, how did you get involved with the Doctor Who website in the year 2000 and beyond?
You see, you're saying happier times, but this was chaos. Literally, I was doing BBC websites on something else, and a guy had moved over to look after the drama and entertainment websites. And at that point, the Doctor Who and cult TV websites like Buffy were all run by a very, very charming ex-nun who didn't watch, you know, she didn't watch Buffy because it was against God. She thought John Pertwee was still Doctor Who. Yes, they sort of rang me up and said, well, you've watched Doctor Who, haven't you? Could you do this? And I was like, this would be my dream job. So I went over and I did it. And in some ways it was my dream job. And in other ways, it was a very, very weird time to be working on all these brands, especially because every year, they would say, well, Doctor Who's done very well, but how many more years do you think Doctor Who has in it? We should probably look at mothballing the Doctor Who website this year. And then that tune changed. But yeah, the cult TV websites were an embarrassment for BBC Online because they had a tiny, tiny budget, of which a third was stolen to moderate web forums, which proves how early 2000s it was. Which were just hideous, hideous things that even the moderators couldn't actually make function as nice interactive things because the software didn't work. So we just poured more money into it. That's the most UK thing, where you build an application that doesn't work and then you throw more money at it until eventually you just give up in disgust and walk away. But yeah, the Doctor Who websites were fantastically popular. And that was in the end almost the doom of the cult TV websites, because they were so popular and they ran out of ways to prove that they were not popular. They kept on changing the metrics for how you would judge your audience. And eventually they kept on still being very, very popular. And eventually they just turned around and went, do you know what? We are super serving that audience. So that's why we're closing them all down. So it was all closed down. And then luckily Doctor Who was renewed on TV, and instead of going, oh, we've made a terrible mistake closing these websites down, they went, oh, well, I guess Doctor Who can carry on for a bit, you know, because the first series will happen and it will be a terrible, you know, it will tank. Don't get your hopes up. But once that's over, I think you can go. And there was a period when I was offered the chance to leave the tattered ruins that were Doctor Who and go and work on The One Show, which is our sort of the BBC's cozy sofa community and consumer affairs program. But I stuck with Doctor Who for another couple of years. And it was really interesting working on Doctor Who down in BBC Wales, because I had an office in BBC Wales. And that was quite fun. It was interesting. Especially because there were some people at BBC Wales who were incredibly welcoming, because I was thrilled to be down in Cardiff and I sort of loved my life in Cardiff. But there are other people who couldn't forgive me for coming down from London to build a website. And I'm going, oh, well, that's what I'm doing. And I'm sort of being very enthusiastic about it all. But yeah, it's a very curious time, very exciting time, but a very curious time.
You also began writing Doctor Who fiction, and your name appears on many, many books, most of which I have on my Kindle, which is a shame because you really can't have somebody autograph a Kindle. But I do have all the target size versions of your Doctor Who novels. So I have the target cutdowns of Pirate Planet, City of Death, and of course the book we're talking about today, The Giggle, which Smudge is sitting on, but here it is. How did you first get into writing the Doctor Who novelizations and adaptations?
Oh, I'll do this really, really quickly. While I was working on various sites for BBC Wales, I did the Tortured website, and because we did it for very little money, we had lots and lots of stories on there that we all wrote amongst the team. And one of the stories was the basis for an episode of Torchwood, and so that was sort of, people went, oh, okay, right, fine. It was a thing where I was called into a room and said, you know, we're going to be basing an episode of Torchwood on something that you wrote. And I went, that's good. And they went, you will not be paid any money, but we just want to check we have the right to do this. And I went, of course you have the right to do this. And they went, oh, good. And I said, do I get a tiny little credit on screen? They went, oh, no, of course not. We have the rights to do this.
Oh, boy.
So that was that. Then at the same time, a play I'd written when I was at school won an award in Los Angeles, which got noticed. But you know, it was a weird time because I think I'd just turned 30 and 17-year-old me had a much better career than I did, so that was weird. So yeah, and then after I'd left, the chance came to write a Torchwood book because somebody much famous had dropped out of writing a Torchwood book 6 weeks before it was due to be published. So I was rung up and told, do you want to write a book? And I'm like, yes, I would love to write a novel. This is very exciting. Let me go away and think. And they went, no. You've got 6 weeks. Actually, you've got 5 weeks because we need a week for you to make changes. And I'm like, okay. So that's what happened.
And you have written books with or based on Douglas Adams, Tom Baker, Amy Pond. You have a remarkably big bookshelf. Focusing on The Giggle, how did this assignment come to you?
I mean, that came in utter secrecy. That period, there was a period where there was no they were recruiting for a new brand manager on Doctor Who, and they needed somebody to do product approvals. And because I'd worked at BBC Studios, I went, do you just want to look after product approvals for a few months? So I did. And this was all while new Doctor Who was kicking off. And it was quite exciting because it meant that Scott Hancock, who I've worked with a lot, had become the script editor on new series of Doctor Who. Because I'd been NDA'd up to the gills, Scott could ring me up and go, I've had a really horrible day at work, or I've had a really brilliant day at work. And he couldn't go into details, but he just went, it's really nice to be able to ring up somebody and talk to them and know that I'm not going to get into trouble. And I'm like, cool. And product approvals was really good and really fun, but it was very nebulous because you were sort of aware of what was going on in Doctor Who, but you didn't have any specifics. And they were very careful because at an early stage, you went, how much do you want to know about the new series? And I went, as little as possible, please. And they went, okay, well, here is a menu of things that cannot be approved. And I'm like, oh, this is great. So I really enjoyed that, and a period in it, they just went, oh, do you want to know a little bit more about the new series? And I went, no, I'm very happy just being excited when it goes out. And they went, oh, that's a shame. And that was sort of the next thing I knew, I was commissioned to do one of the books. And that was quite exciting, but also it made life bumpy because, you know, you couldn't talk to anyone about it. You know, even things like being told David Tennant is coming back and Catherine Tate. And I went, oh, right, that's very exciting. And Scott said, you know, you will tell somebody, it's fine. Just tell us who you've told and we'll take care of it. And I did say to Scott, well, I've told my cat. And Scott went, that's fine. And then a month later, my cat died. So.
I will not tell Smudge a thing. Smudge is sitting here listening to every word.
Yeah, there you go. Doctor Who kills cats. But yeah, you know, actually working on it. But the sheer joy of getting those scripts and reading them, just going, I cannot believe this is real. Because, you know, that was my golden period of excitement, that season with David and Catherine, because I'd just finished working on the show. I no longer had any idea what was coming out. So I was very excited by it. That was my proper Doctor Who, the stuff where I could lurch from week to week, gasping with excitement. So I was so pleased that there were like three new episodes of it. And yeah, just getting to watch them all like a year before everybody else, which is lovely, but also I couldn't tell anyone. Because I know that there's this fan urge to brag about stuff, but literally I just couldn't see any advantage to going, I know something you don't know. And it would be interesting because you'd hang out. I have friends who are Doctor Who fans and they'd all be sort of swapping spoilers and things that they knew and things that they'd heard. And I shouldn't be telling you this, but I've heard this. And I'm sat there just looking sort of a little bit, you know, whilst they're swapping all these things that they should know or shouldn't know or definitely do know or definitely don't know. And I'm looking completely blank.
The story that you were given is a sequel to one of Doctor Who's more controversial tales, Celestial Toymaker. So let's backtrack and talk about that a moment.
Why is it controversial?
It wasn't controversial. It was considered a classic for the longest time. Then the missing episode was released on video and it was 10 minutes of people playing hopscotch. And then fandom turned to it in about 2011. This is coincident with the rise of Twitter and starts finding what were perceived to be racist or colonialist messages in the story. And that dominated the discourse for a good 10 years until the actual truth came out, that the story was made so chaotically that there wasn't time for anybody to be racist because it all came together by accident five minutes before cameras turned on.
I mean, it does feature a word that should never be in Doctor Who. I've seen all of the very, very cogent arguments about why the Celestial Toymaker, you have to be very careful about how you use the word celestial, which, you know, you just kind of go, crikey, I had no idea about that. You know, there's my white privilege going off. But, you know, I think there is an argument to be made that the Tales of Wang Chiang is a very, very, very clever, knowing satire about yellow peril fiction, written by a man who knows everything about yellow peril fiction. And it's very nuanced and cunning and exciting. And in no way, I think, is Robert Holmes's heart racist when he's writing Tales of Wang Chiang. He's putting a lot of thought into laughing at all these ridiculous tropes there are about Chinese people and immigration, but I don't necessarily think it's something that should have been done in hindsight, because a lot of the audience would just be going, this is Doctor Who laughing at Chinese people. It's like, it's Doctor Who laughing at the yellow peril. Do you not understand what's going on here? And it's always very dangerous when somebody goes, you're not intelligent enough to understand this story. I don't understand why you feel upset. You never want to be that person. And that is the problem with the Tales of Wang Chiang, but at least thought went into it. Whereas I think you're absolutely right. The Celestial Toymaker is a gorgeous concept that ended up being hurriedly rushed together with a cast they already had, half-built sets that they already had. And they got to the end of it and they didn't recast their actor in the middle of it. So, you know, a big end result, glorious performance by Michael Goff. And well done, Peter Purves and Jackie Lane, for holding it all together while it rattled on. But it's, you know, it's a story that haunts you, even though the individual episodes might not be any good. In the same way that we're all haunted by the idea of Galaxy 4, even though now we've seen an episode of Galaxy 4, we're going, oh.
The direction on the surviving episode 3, Derek Martinez in Galaxy 4, blew me across the room when I first saw it recovered in 2011 or 2012. Whereas my first exposure to Toymaker was this novelization, which comes out towards the end of 1986. And yeah. It's easy to read. It's only 120 pages. I was excited by the name Jerry Davis, but it turns out, apart from the introduction, he didn't write this. It was written by his credited co-author. So this was the surviving text. Yeah, a young TV writer and producer, still active in television, from what I understand. When did you first read this book? When did you first see Toymaker as a surviving recon or surviving episode? When did you first hear the audio release?
When I was a child. You know, you have to remember that I think we just had the Target books. It's like, I know I got a copy of the audio back in those days, you know, in my late teens, and it was very exciting. Glorious, gorgeous stuff. How exciting to be able to finally hear the Celestial Toymaker. You know, listening to people play hopscotch, great fun. What a gorgeous audio drama experience that was. The book came first. The book definitely came first. We didn't even have video recons when I was a child. We didn't even have video recorders. You fancy Yanks. I just had the book and I was like aware that the Celestial Toymaker was this glorious, gorgeous, missing classic. And I remember finding the book very weird, but I think Alison Bingeman? Bingeman. Should we go for Bingeman? Alison Bingeman.
I was going for Bingeman, but I think your pronunciation is much more entertaining, so we'll go with that. Bingeman.
Bingeman. Let's go for Bingeman. Alison Bingeman. You know, you imagine that Jerry Davis sort of summons her into his office and says, you know what, I've got to write a Doctor Who book. I can't be bothered. I'm really busy. I think you should write it. And I imagine that Bingeman is just there and she's like, oh God, I really want to do this. Can I watch any episodes? He's like, nope. Do you have any scripts? Yes. And just discovering that you're writing a Doctor Who book where everything is missing. There are no photos apart from two of Michael Goff. And that she has to go away and write this book. And it's an incredible read, because I did obviously reread the book when I was writing The Giggle. And it's an extraordinary book because it's almost the telling of it's almost a book about a woman who wants to write a book. And during the process of writing a book, realizes she never wants to write a book again. And possibly by the end of it, never wants to read a book again, because she's having to try and make sense of something that makes absolutely no sense. She's having to write about people playing hopscotch, and she's American. Poor Alison Bingeman is trying to write about hopscotch, and is probably turning to Jerry Davis and going, can you explain hopscotch to me? Because there's no Wikipedia then. She's having to go on what's in the script. It reads like an increasingly baffled person who has a terrible job where she's having to type stuff out and try and make sense of it until eventually she can stop. That's my take on the book. It's an incredibly weird Target book. It's not necessarily a dreadful Target book. It's just, or it's almost Paul Marzian in its vague sense of unease as you carry on reading it.
Cyril, and we don't have Billy Bunter in the States, so that would have been lost on us.
Yeah, but yeah, just the whole idea of, you see, this is the whole thing. Billy Bunter, Americans have no idea what Billy Bunter is. We all know who Billy Bunter is. People of my age who grew up, because, you know, we had Cracker Jack, we had stuff like that. Billy Bunter was turning up on everything. Poor Alison Bingeman just being handed a whole pile of cultural stuff that she doesn't understand and has to try and explain, and also adapt into a book. And she's there going, I'm writing a science fiction book, but it's about people skipping. You know, has anybody actually tracked Alison Bingerman down and given her a hug? Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I don't think it's her fault. It's just somebody being handed a really tough brief and going, well, give it a go. And she gives it a go. She definitely gives it a go. And we have a book.
It's also a bit frustrating because on this show, I go on publication order, and we are up to Celestial Toymaker this week. The other 1986 books are of varying levels of complexity. Many of them are between 150 and 180 pages long. They're starting to deviate from the script. You have Donald Cotton doing his Donald Cotton thing. This is a very traditional, basic novelization, and it's only 121 pages because there just wasn't room, either from the author or from the surviving material, to go out and do a full-on reimagining or expansion. Fortunately, we have the giggle from that. You do have some homages to Celestial Toymaker. For example, the word Yaru appears in your novelization. Yeah, I've never had such an emotional reaction to seeing the word Yaru in print, even though I can't pronounce it quite the way that Peter Stevens does.
Yaru! Hooray for me! Hurrah! Huzzah!
I was on a panel with you and Gary Russell and Mark Morris at Galley 2 months ago in Los Angeles talking about the three novelizations at once, and both of them said they were not allowed to change anything, and they were under very specific orders not to add any embellishments. You, on the other hand, were not given that brief. What was the brief that you were given?
Have fun. Obviously, it's very difficult to talk about this because I'm still coming to terms with the fact I can talk about it, but it's the fact that Scott took me for a walk and he said, okay, we're working out how to get you script access, but just so you are aware, you're going to have to write a musical number and dance scenes, and you're going to have to describe them. And the only thing we can think of is that you have to have fun with the book. So I went away and I had fun with the book and handed it in and thought, well, I hope that's okay. And by and large, they let me get away with what I did. But nobody actually said you must stick exactly to what's written. It was made very clear to me that I had to honor the text of the original script up to all of the Toymaker's dialogue is transcribed exactly from the script. So all the spellings are exactly carried over from the script. Word for word, nothing is left out. And that was very difficult because I had a virtual copy of the script, not a copy of the script I could cut, copy, or paste from. So when you're typing words across from another screen and they're spelled as English words, that's easy enough. But when you're having to sort of type out and you're just like, this is all gibberish, and I'm having to type this out and get it right. I had a clash with a copy editor because Russell had typed the Vlinx's dialogue as the mechanoids in the Dalek comics. So it was all block caps with three crosses in between each word. And the copy editor took that out. I put it all back in. And then a version of that went to Russell. And Russell was like, what the? Put it all back. I was made very aware that the version of the script I had been given was the version of the script they would like to be adapted. So every Wilf line that was extra had to carry over. Every extra line had to carry over, which meant that because of the weird Chinese whispers walls of secrecy that were going on, Steve Cole had been allowed to see the episode, but hadn't got access to my version of the script. So there were moments that I had included faithfully from my version of the script that Steve Cole was going, oh, I'm not sure we should be having this here. I'm not sure how Russell would take having these extra. I think these lines are very good, but I don't think they should be here. And I'm going, these lines were by Russell, and that's why they're in here. So that was, you know, that was a very interesting point where people were trying to preserve the purity of Russell's vision. Steve Cole was trying to preserve the purity of Russell's vision. And it was like, oh, God, this is like the early church basically going to war over what is the word of God. How brilliant.
So some of the chapters in your book could rightly be described as apocrypha.
Oh, well done. We're soon going to be mentioning the Book of Esther, which is my favorite book of the Apocrypha.
We just got finished in the States celebrating the Jewish holiday based on the Book of Esther, Purim, and we still have some leftover Humantash and cookies. So I'm all about the Book of Esther here, but this
Whereas
is not
I'm a, in Turkey and we're in the middle of Eid. Well done, us.
And this is not a religious podcast, so I will let that sort itself out in the background. I want to talk more about the games playing aspect of your book. As a child, I would mark up my target books by drawing in a line where the cliffhanger was. Later on, if it was a Hartnell book, I would write the name of the episode rather than part two or part three. And my copy of the program guides are marked up with all sorts of asterisks and circles and underlines. I could not bring myself to fill in this maze with pencil, but I was able to solve it once, and then I was never able to solve it again. That begs the question, is it the same maze in every book, or do they change the maze up for every copy of the book that went out?
Oh, well done. That would be the most joyous game. But yes, that is – madly, that's not the maze I drew, or rather it is the maze I drew, but then Steve Cole had somebody professional redraw it, and then that had to be resolved because the poor person who took over as Brand – approvals manager had to solve every game in the book, because the thing that if you haven't read the book is a series of games. It starts off as an ordinary target book, and then it becomes more and more a series of games until you realize that you, as the reader, are playing a game, and it's a game that you might not win. That was enormous fun, just sticking games in and puzzles and things to be solved. And there are hidden acrostics where obviously I've had to explain to the BBC where everything hidden is, just in case there are naughty messages. But yes, the book is full of games and puzzles and jokes, and often it's at the reader's expense, which I just thought was fun.
Page 29, which is the maze that I refer to, is a map of the American president's brain. And then the American president shows up a couple of times later in the book in less than flattering circumstances. This is not a political podcast in the same way it's not a religious podcast, but did you have any particular president in mind?
The scenes of the American president are in the book. Are in the script. So I copy them over. The American president is described exactly as he's described in the script.
Minus the map, of course.
Yes.
And you have a fiendishly clever word search on page 45 made up of two letters in repeating order. I didn't have too much trouble with this one. But there is a much more complicated word search towards the end of the book, and I don't want to spoil it for readers who don't have it yet. It's only just come out in the States, and I had to get my copy from a third-party vendor because Amazon is already out. But the word search on page 178 may possibly contain spoilers for the forthcoming season. I didn't want to read too closely.
Yes. I mean, this is a word search that contains spoilers. And that's great, especially because some of the clues and some of the answers, I don't know what they mean.
Were you given instructions for the word search by Russell, or did you come up with all those letters yourself?
I worked on it with Scott and with product approvals. So there's stuff hidden in there that I'm like, okay, I can be in there. There's a lot of commentary on what's just happened, sneaked in there. There was a point where they asked to have one of the clues taken out of the finished puzzle, which they were completely within their rights to, but it's very difficult to take a clue out of a word search.
That's a good point, because the whole puzzle collapses without it.
Yes, it does.
My favorite part of the book, and I told you this over email as we were scheduling our recording date, As a child who started reading in the late 70s and spent most of the 80s with his nose buried in a book rather than doing other things such as sports or dating or sometimes even schoolwork, I spent a lot of time with the Choose Your Own Adventure books. Those were very influential in the States. Neil Patrick Harris, the American actor who plays Toymaker, wrote his autobiography in Choose Your Own Adventure format.
Well, that's incredible.
And you have a good section of the book from that POV, Neil Patrick Harris's As a Choose Your Own Adventure section. I have a ton of questions about this, but number one, how is that preserved for the audiobook? I can't imagine that's very easy to do on audio.
Nope. That crashed and burned. I mean, it's very, you know, we finished the book, we handed it in, Steve, Carl, and I were like, oh, we should probably have a chat about the audiobook version, because at some point there might be an audiobook version, but we didn't hear anything. And then I got a very nice email from Michael Stevens at BBC Audio saying, I'm very much looking forward to recording the audiobook of The Giggle next week, can't wait to read it. And I thought, oh, and that at the back of my head, I went, there's a thing that I should say, but, and then I got a slightly, can I phone you? And obviously he was very worried. And I said, well, it's really easy, Michael. You just chop all those, the Choose Your Own Adventure game out, and you just lose a few of the other chapters that just aren't going to work on audio, because you can't really have Dan Starkey describe a brain or a word search on audio. Just leave those chapters out. You'll be fine. We're golden. And Michael Stevens went, no, because we have to have the same number of chapters as the printed version in case people are using WhisperSync for audio. Because if they're skipping between the printed version and the audiobook version, the whole thing just gets out of alignment and it all falls apart.
Oh, wow.
So it had to be the same number of chapters. And I went, but like, 7,000 words of the book is padding because it's a Choose Your Own Adventure, so it's repeating the same information. And Michael went, they've got to have the same number of chapters. So I just reordered all of it so that instead of Donna Noble having to make her way through a maze of corridors, she just walks through a lot of corridors. Dan Starkey read it all. Bless him. But if you've ever listened to the audiobook version and gone, this bit wangs on a bit, that's why. But the ebook version, geniusly, for the Choose Your Own Adventure, Steve Cole learned so much about coding ebooks that actually, when you play the Choose Your Own Adventure, it is possible to get stuck in an infinite loop, which delights me.
Which is exactly what happened to me. I got caught between sections 21, 25, and 26. And then I realized there was no way out. I will say that as a youth of questionable morals who played the Choose Your Own Adventure books in the 1980s, and I've actually been rebuilding my collection,
Memories! I had that one!
This is The Forbidden Castle by Edward Packard. Edward Packard is still alive, 93, updates his blog daily. Fascinating individual. I would shamelessly cheat. So can I tell you, my strategy for the Choose Your Own Adventures was, if I was given a choice between page numbers, always take the lower page number, because the higher page number is more likely to bring you right to the end of the book and one of the nasty endings. That was my first strategy. My second strategy is, if I picked a wrong ending, I would give myself a do-over and pretend that the bad ending, most of which resulted in death or dismemberment, never happened. And my third sheet, there's actually one Choose Your Own Adventure, also an Edward Packard book, inside UFO 5440. The only way to win the book is by cheating. So when I got trapped in the infinite loop, I decided to cheat my way out. And it turns out you wrote the book specifically so that you need to cheat in order to get out of the maze. You even acknowledge it in the text. So you figured out how to write to me and my specific Choose Your Own Adventure gameplay style.
No, I mean, you can get through it quite legitimately without cheating. But there's, you know, we've honored everything from we grew up with fighting fantasy books. So the whole idea of there has to be a hidden page that nobody can get to that has a message on it. And you can legitimately go through the maze quite easily. But you can also very easily get just trapped in repeating blocks of text, which is probably very, very boring. And I know somebody who kept on ending up back on chapter 7, which in the ebook version, because when I did Fighting Fantasy game books when I was a child, I would use my fingers. So I would keep lots. I would use fingers as bookmarks so that, you know, if you find yourself going down the wrong path, you can just skip back along your fingers so that, you know, you don't have to fight the orc or fall down the well. But with this one, it's because it was so beautifully programmed in the ebook, people just got hopelessly lost, which is great, and kept on ending up at a very early chunk of the book, which I realized during revising I could actually do that. I could fling people out to a completely different section early on in the book and make it seem as though this story has been going on for a very long time.
And there's two choices in the book where you can actually fast forward directly to the final chapter, or move, I should say, 55.
Yes.
So there's a way to finish the book without ever actually reaching the climax or the bi-generation.
Yes, which is exactly what, you know, if you're playing against the toy maker, this is exactly what the toy maker would want. Because the conceit of the book is... rather than, you know, because over the last few years, the idea of celebrities write Doctor Who books. So Tom Baker has written a Doctor Who book. Sophie Aldred has written a Doctor Who book. Fraser Hines has written a Doctor Who book. And the idea of what if the villain gets to write a target novel? And obviously he's not necessarily going to play fair. And the whole point of the Giggle book is that it's all about a character who always plays by the rules, but at the same time the book is cheating and the book cheats all the time. So how reliable is the narrator? And when you get to the end of the book, have you in fact won the book, or have you just reached the end of the book?
I did, and I'll confess, I went back and I ended up reading the Choose Your Own Adventure section in sequential order to make sure that I didn't miss anything. So I broke the rules, and I'm sure the toy maker is coming after me to imprison me inside of his gold tooth.
Mm.
Were you aware that Neil Patrick Harris had actually done a Choose Your Own Adventure autobiography?
No, that makes life even, that makes it sound like I'm clever. That's amazing. What a great idea for an autobiography. That's amazing. Sadly, no.
Oh, well, Neil Patrick Harris was an important part of my childhood. His first sitcom came out in 1989 when I was a very impressionable teenager, so I've been following his career for a very long time. So him winding up on Doctor Who was a wonderful thing for me, and many other Americans, I should say. So The Giggle at 218 pages is one of the longer Target books. It's longer than any of the Targets that came out between 1973 and until John Peel was able to come back and do those two Dalek books in the mid-90s.
Oh, God. I mean, wow.
No, it flew by very fast, though, the 218 pages, whereas Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma, which is about the same length, is, one could charitably say, a lot more tedious. Did you have any specific Target influences in mind when you sat down to write your Target books? Any authors you're specifically paying homage to, or turns of phrase you might want to be incorporating?
I mean, it's a fair question. I do know when I started work on Scratch Man with Tom, I started reading, because it was very important to Tom that we also got the voice of Ian Marta in there. So I started reading Ian Marta's Ark in Space and Sontaran Experiment, which, you know, if you, it's fascinating, especially the Sontaran Experiment, because that is a book clearly written by a man who has stood in Dartmoor and suffered, you know, the book is very much much more about how Harry Sullivan suffered on film whilst his nice friends Liz and Tom had jolly japes and broke collarbones while poor old Ian walked through mud. It's a very, very interesting book. And from that, I think I started just compulsively rereading Target books. And, you know, everyone should reread Target books. They're just joyous. And because they are so slim and so short, apart from mine, You know, that what's not to love about a book that you can pick up, read, and then you still got your whole evening ahead of you. You know, a Target book should never feel like homework. You are right, Tolo and the Earthlink Dilemma, I'd read when I was a kid. And it sits on the shelf, but I don't think I'm going to revisit it. Whereas, you know, I think last year I did reread Harry Sullivan's War, and hooray for it. You know, there is so much good stuff there to be endlessly loved and enjoyed. And I think it's Mark Gatiss who says that, you know, whenever he's having a bad day, he will just find 2 hours to sit down and reread Planet of the Daleks. And you just go, that's absolutely right. You know, we should all have that simple joy available to us. Just as I think for me, it's picking up Doctor Who in an exciting adventure with the Daleks and just going, I'll just read a few pages. And then all of a sudden it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're very, very, very drunk, but very happy and thinking and slightly questioning Barbara's lifestyle choices, because Ian Chesterton in that book is absolutely, he's clearly read one of those books about how to neg your way into.
Hi, this is Jason from the future. Sorry, we had an audio disconnect / internet drop at this point in the conversation, and I was never able to retrieve the rest of that sentence. Let's rejoin my interview with James Goss, already in progress.
There's much love in nearly every Target book, although I did, when I was doing my mass reread, I did try rereading The Smugglers, and that's a very weird book. Have you done The Smugglers yet? That must be like around the corner for you.
What's funny is that Harry Sullivan's War was last week. That comes out October 86, so 1 month before Celestial Toymaker. So Jim Sangster was my guest, and Harry Sullivan's War has a lot of meaning for him. We were able to pinpoint that a lot of Harry Sullivan's War is autobiographical for Ian Martyr, because Harry is said to be the same age that Ian was when he wrote it. The first part of the book takes place on Dartmoor, same as the Santaran experiment. And the way that Harry is portrayed is similar to how Harry is eventually portrayed in Scratchman, where there's a long sequence of Harry comically stumbling his way out of trouble, unaware that anything bad is happening behind him. Portions of Harry Sullivan's War are exactly like that. So it's a fascinating book, and it holds up very well, given that it was the last thing published in Ian Martyr's lifetime, I should say.
Yes, one of the really interesting things about Harry Sullivan's War is as soon as you realize that Ian Martyr was a diabetic and really struggled with the eating regime necessary, there is an awful lot in Harry Sullivan's War about pork pies. It's very interesting that Harry fantasizes an awful lot about eating foods that he shouldn't necessarily be eating. And also there is an incredible, I love the tension between Ian Martyr, who sees himself as sort of a little bit more go-getting and a little bit more dashing, and Harry Sullivan as seen on TV, who was haphazard. So it sort of veers between being a James Bond film and a Mr. Bean James Bond film. And I find that really fascinating, especially because all these women, like in those Rowan Atkinson movies, all these women crack on to Harry, and most women wouldn't. You know, I imagine that Sarah Jane was fond of Harry, but she'd never make a pass at him because, you know, he's a walking disaster. And yet the Harry Sullivan of Harry Sullivan's War is quite suave, quite dashing, goes to the gym, works out quite a lot. Is very foxy with the little ladies, is quite good with a gun, can talk himself out of danger by charm, and you're just like, Harry Sullivan?
And it's also not the book that you're expecting Ian Martyr to write, because Ian's Target novelizations were full of body horror and graphic violence, especially Ark in Space, Santaran Experiment, which has a lot of what you would now call torture porn.
Plus the
invasion, where the character vomits blood.
I was going to say, he pitched forward and vomited a stream of blood. I was asked about that and did the quote and then had to check in a copy. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can remember that. and, you know, the sheer joy of reading the Book of the Dominators and going, this is incredible. And then getting to watch the Dominators and going, this is not incredible. You know, Ian Martin would just wade into any text. I recently reread The Rescue, and, you know, nothing was going to stop Ian Martin. Not even death stopped Ian Martin from novelizing The Rescue full-bloodedly, up to and including having the filthiest sex joke, not just in any Doctor Who book, but possibly even in the erotica books that Virgin later published. On page one, I was just like, that can't be in this book. And you've not yet covered that book, so that's fine. But spoilers, I think it's like page one or two that you're just like, what? What? And Jason, you're trying to work out whether or not you've... Yeah, I'm watching you. I'm watching your head try and remember if you know what the joke is, but it shouldn't be in that book.
This is a point that is coming up. The later Target books came out when I was a teenager and I was finally getting into other things that were not Doctor Who. I know I bought The Smugglers when it came out. I know I read it in 1990 or so. I have not touched it since. And The Smugglers is a strange story because it is in between the War Machines and the 10th Planet and the power of the Daleks. If you're doing the pilgrimage in order, which I did during the pandemic, The Smugglers is a annoying 4-episode speed bump in between 3 phenomenal stories that reinvent what Doctor Who was, is, and could be. And The Smugglers is painfully traditional. But at the same time, The Smugglers is awesome because it is a story about a curse. It is about cursed treasure. And he who discovers the treasure will have the curse put upon him. Somebody curses the Doctor to die. And that happens in the very next serial after The Smugglers. So it's almost intentionally embedded into the narrative of the show. This Smuggler's curse is what gets Doctor Who killed, not just the Cybermen or Mondas or this old body wearing a bit thin. But that's a retcon. The Smugglers by itself is an odd story patronizing towards the past. And it's Brian Hales who nominally also wrote Celestial Toymaker. They'll come to find out he didn't write very much of that script.
Yeah,
it is a strange little speed bump.
This is one of the things where I think the Holy Grail of Doctor Who fans is I would love a script book that is every version of the script of the Celestial Toymaker. And we just don't have that. And it's such a shame because we're just left going, well, what was supposed to happen? And we just don't know.
But coming back to The Rescue, and this is an embarrassing confession, and I may lose a chunk of my audience over this, not least of all yourself. I think The Rescue is the one Doctor Who novelization that I do not recall if I ever read. It was one of the last ones that I bought, and I don't think I ever read it. So when I heard about the sex joke references in the book, I have no recollection of them at all. And my copy of the book, I skimmed through it, does not have the cliffhanger marks that I usually put in when I read a book and I would find the cliffhanger and put in a pencil mark. But I didn't do that. So I think I've never read it. So when it comes up on the show in a few months, you'll be getting my very first unspoiled virgin, if you will, impression of the book.
No, and it's very interesting, especially because he sort of he really, Ian Martyr's The Rescue, and considering that there are very few characters in The Rescue, he makes sure they all suffer, which is quite a lot of going. You know, obviously he gets to destroy an entire spaceship full of people, and Ian Martyr is just there going, yes. and then, whereas the TV version just ends on this whole idea of, you know, the people of Dido. Is it Dido?
Unless you're Adrian Rigelsford, yes, it is Dido. He spelled it quite differently in one of his unauthorized books.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's not the sex joke. Yeah, you know, the TV version just ends on the idea that, you know, there are people still alive on the planet Dido, and they do not wish to be contacted, whereas Ian Martyr is like, ah, you think you have a happy ending? Yum, yum, yum. Ian Martyr smells blood. And you know, it's quite the ending. He really, really does The Rescue. And it's a great book, considering that actually not very much happens in The Rescue. He managed to make not very much happen over the length of a full-length Target book. Whereas, you know, Terence Dix managed to take all 10 episodes of The War Games and squeeze them into a normal Target-length book without you feeling anything was missing. You know, it's extraordinary how much a Target book can hold, or how little, because I know that the Star Beast book is longer than the Wild Blue Yonder, but the Wild Blue Yonder has more pages. There's some extraordinary games with typesetting that are going on with those three books.
Yeah, I actually have them, both of them right here on my desk. And yes, the font in Wild Blue Yonder is much bigger than the font in the Star Beast.
Yes, and I reached the end of my page allowance because of all the games and stuff. I think the book is technically 1,000 words under length, but also it uses the maximum number of pages it is allowed. So the dedication had to go underneath the copyright, which means that the dedication is one extra game that is hidden in the book.
I was today years old when I learned that. In fact, I'm looking for it now because I managed to miss this. And I'm missing it again because I don't see a dedication on the... Oh, there it is. Ah! It's dedicated to me, to the losers. Thank you.
There you go.
Thanks, James.
I got sent this email going, everybody else has sort of given kind acknowledgements and humble to be... who do you wish to dedicate it to? Do you have a wife or a dog or anything? I'm like, I have none of these things. So I snuck in a dedication to Players of Games. And was then told, we don't actually have any pages that it can go on, so we won't put it in. And then Steve Cole was like, I found somewhere where we can sneak it in. And then somebody said, well, legally, can we actually put a message in amongst the copyrights? And that went backwards and forwards. And then it was decided that, you know, if we can say that it was the book was printed from a sustainable forest, then we can definitely sneak in an acknowledgement. A dedication. We can sneak a dedication in there. So there's a hidden dedication. So there's one extra game, which is find the dedication in 6-point print.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, so I'll try and limit myself to two more questions. And the first question is based on a memory of what you said at the Galley panel 2 months ago. And many of the 1990s Virgin and BBC books were famous for name checks and embedding the names of fans or friends of the author in the text or in the story. You have what appears to be an email exchange with a copyright lawyer in the middle of your song and dance sequence. How did that come to be? And is your copyright lawyer a real person?
Yes, because I handed the book in very, very faithfully, obviously, as I've said, with the musical number intact, and then it turned out that the Spice Girls song had been cleared on all platforms in perpetuity except the novelization. And I said, well, can it be cleared? And they went, no, that would be very expensive. And the suggestion came from someone very clever at Bad Wolf that instead of it being one song, the toy maker is singing all songs. So a very happy evening was spent pulling together one line from many, many songs and putting them in. And that turned out to be, from a copyright point of view, even more hideously expensive than clearing all of the stuff.
Oh, wow.
So that was the point at which a copyright lawyer was involved with, you know, a music copyright lawyer had to be brought into the conversation in terms of what could we put in the book. And I was going, well, we can't lose the key scene. For many people, the regeneration is the key scene. But, I'm a very, very camp old homosexual. So for me, any dance number is the key scene in any episode. You know, if you had a regeneration that was also a musical number, whoop, whoop, there. That was very complicated. And in the end, the music copyright lawyer said you can't have any lines from the song in there. We have the glorious idea of the celestial toy maker coming up. Sorry, we have the glorious idea of the toy maker coming up against a music copyright lawyer. And I went, let's put the music copyright lawyer in the book. And obviously the real copyright lawyer is not called Miss Pockleton, but some of her emails do appear in the book. And because they're a copyright lawyer, we had to get her permission to include her emails in the book, which is great.
That is what we call privileged work product here in the States.
Privileged work product. Wow. This is like when I'm watching The Good Fight and somebody says fruit of the poison tree.
Speaking of great TV shows filmed right here in New York, along with all of its various sequels. So bonus question, Neil Patrick Harris, not only longtime actor, been in the movies, also a stage performer, was on Broadway in Cabaret playing the Master of Ceremonies, the role made famous by Joel Grey in the 1970s movie. And Neil Patrick Harris's character in this book speaks a lot of German, taking the Toymaker's disguise. Were you tempted to work in Willkommen, Bienvenue into the book?
Absolutely not. Bear in mind, it's a song. It's from a copyrighted song. Jason, what are you doing?
I don't want to get Mrs. Pockleton or whatever the name was in the book on my case. Miss Pockleton, yes.
Yes, it was originally named Miss Pickering after the BBC has a literal enforcer of brand security whose surname is Pickering. And I was like, let's put Pickering in the book. And everybody went, you realize if you say his name three times, he will appear and have you fired. So it became Pockleton because I just thought that was a really, really fun name. And nobody in real life is called Pockleton. And there probably aren't any copyright lawyers called Pockleton.
Well, there should be. I know a lot of lawyers in New York City, and none of them have a name quite that interesting.
There you go. Any more questions? You look like you've got one more question. Your cat has one more question. Hi, Smudge.
Smudge has spent most of the last hour trying to bite my hands and attack me when she's not directly staring into the monitor standing in front of me so that you're talking to Smudge rather than myself. Now, this is a question that I ask just about everybody. It's a two-parter. Your favorite Target novelization or the one that has the most meaning to you personally, and your favorite Target cover painting?
Oh, good question. Favorite Target novel without any doubt is The Abominable Snowman. Mm. Which is it's a gorgeous rompy book and manages to be an epic that's 23,000 words long, and also has a gorgeous cover and just means so much to me. I remember reading that as a child in the back of my parents' car while they were driving. I was a very car sick child, so that, you know, it's, I loved The Abominable Snowman so much I was prepared to risk sickness whilst reading it. So, you know, I think The Abominable Snowman is just one of the best books in the Target range. And, you know, it's the one where when I met Terence Dix, I got him to sign. That's how much The Abominable Snowman means to me. It's weirdly, I've discovered it's one of the six Targets that were translated into Turkish, because now I live in Turkey. I am clearly learning all these things. And there is Dr. Kim. Ve korkunç karadamlar, which unfortunately Google Translate, it very literally does mean the terrible snowmen, but Google Translate goes for something else, gets it very, very wrong, and says the naughty black men, and you're just like, oh god. So yes, if you ever see a copy of Dr. Kim Ve korkunç karadamlar, do not Google Lens it, because it will hate crime. That was a real thing, because, you know, I saw the title and I was like, oh, I can't quite work that out in my head. And Google Translate was like, it's this. And we were all sat around weirdly at Gallifrey going, what one's that? Oh, God. Get it? Oh, God. And then realizing, oh, no, it's actually that one, and therefore it's fine. But also, woo-hoo. Honestly, that's just such a gorgeous book. And in terms of cover, I mean, why make anybody choose? I'm going to pick the cover of The Five Doctors, because that, as a child, was transcendent. The original paperback cover of The Five Doctors, which, you know, is almost three-dimensional in its haunting, exciting, expensive 80s-ness beauty, where it appears to be holograms and silver stenciling and so many gorgeous, exciting things. And, you know, there's a real joy to finding copies in secondhand bookshops, which either are not silver printed or the silver printing has rubbed off from love. You know, the Five Doctors is almost like the scratch and sniff. Oh, you know, those lottery cards where you scratch it to see if you've won a thing. That is the cover of the Five Doctors, where it is a cover that has disintegrated over time. So nobody knows what it should actually look like. So, yes, the Five Doctors is the most visually compelling cover. And also, Jason, you've completely vanished behind your cat. So I now feel as though I'm trying to enthuse to the slow blinks of an unimpressed cat rather than a podcast host, which is how things should be.
I will say that I devoted 3 episodes of the show to debating whether or not Five Doctors is the greatest Doctor Who story of all time. And it came close, although I had multiple guests on debating the topic. So I am a complete Five Doctors fan, but you are the first person to mention the Five Doctors cover when I asked that question. And that is the perfect answer, because you're right. The holographic cover with the silver, it is a cut above any of the other traditional paintings.
Yeah.
It is a moment of awe for you sitting there in 1983. And coming back to the Turkish version of Doctor Who and the Terrible Snowman, given that the character was described as a Turk in the novelization of Tomb of the Cybermen, I'm wondering now if there's a joke about Doctor Who and the abominable Toberman in there somewhere.
No, I wouldn't go for that. Interestingly, The Crusades hasn't been translated into Turkish.
Probably for very good reason.
Oh, yeah. I imagine they went down the list of available stories and went, oh, we'll have Dr. Kim Ve Darlekla. Yeah, we'll definitely do that one. And they also left the Zabi alone. Yeah.
One of my guests a few weeks ago, Nathan from Pixel Who, grew up in Cairo, or spent several of his adolescent years in Cairo, and had to receive Doctor Who by VHS import from the States, and every tape had to be watched by the Egyptian authorities for censorship. And they passed through his off-air copy of Pyramids of Mars in Egypt. That must have been an interesting hour and a half at the antiquities / censorship headquarters.
Oh. Oh, God. This is similar to when Tenzin Wang Chiang, I showed my Australian Chinese flatmate Tenzin Wang Chiang, going, you know, this is a really, really clever, and we got 10 minutes in, she went, could you actually turn this shit off, please? And I was like, no, you don't understand, the giant rat hasn't yet turned out. She went, no, absolutely no. You know, it is weird which Doctor Who's do and do not travel both in time and space. And I would argue that, yes, Pyramids of Mars having to be watched by the authorities in Cairo. It's kind of like that whole the whole thing from Gavin and John at Dalek 6388 about how Dalek's master plan definitely made it to Australia, and then because it was labeled as being quite violent, it ended up in a warehouse in the airport next to the only Australian copy of Deep Throat. And that was the last sighting of all the episodes of the Daleks Master Plan that were intended for Australia. Maybe it's still on a pile to be watched, and someday somebody is going to clear their entry and go, oh, okay, I'll clear them all.
Or there's going to be a 1970s X-rated film festival in Sydney, and they're going to reach for the film can to show Deep Throat for the first time in that country, and they're going to end up watching The Destruction of Time instead.
Well, that would be gorgeous, but you know the luck that we all have. It will be either episode 2, 5, or 10. I remember years ago working on a online campaign for the BBC Archives, where we had a website called Treasure Hunt, and people could come up with things that were missing. And obviously, you know, there were some amazing finds that happened as part of it. And the two Doctor Who finds, one was Sue Molden was like, oh, God, somebody's rung up because they've got the first Dalek story again. We're always getting that back. Because there were, it turned out, so many prints of the first Dalek story that whenever they run a BBC Archives thing, somebody else has another copy of the first Dalek story. But the other thing is that somebody found in a loft an episode of late 1960s Doctor Who on the predecessor to VHS, which was some kind of like Philips format tape. And they managed to find a working player and they loaded it in and they were very excited. And it was the Space Pirates and it was episode two. And, you know, you can just imagine just sitting there, and because there, you know, there were no pre-titles things, just being like, go on, go on, go on, go, ooh, 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 ooh.
And this explains why the person who recorded Space Pirates episode two off air didn't come back to record 3 through 6.
No, but maybe they recorded episode one. And then they recorded over it with episode two, and then they went, I'm done.
That's like my story of videotaping the Five Doctors off air in 1984 and missing the last 5 minutes. Imagine if that was the only surviving copy of Five Doctors anywhere in the world. Bruce of putting on the ring and then the tape cuts out.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating, but it also is one of the reasons why the UK is much better than America, because obviously you'd have had the Five Doctors shown with adverts. So how are you expecting to fit it all onto a cassette, you beautiful, young, foolish child?
PBS, publicly funded, only has ads for sponsors and in-between programs. They do not interrupt the program to show an ad, but this was pledge drive season, so every 20 minutes, they cut back to the studio on Long Island, New York, and have a bunch of talking heads ask you to call the studio and pledge money to Doctor Who. So I deliberately set a 3-hour recording block to accommodate all the pledge breaks, and I still ended up underestimating by 5 minutes.
There you go. You know, even when you're just like, well, I'll have you know that it was on PBS, and PBS never interrupts a program, except when they do interrupt a program, they interrupted it so badly that the Five Doctors have been ruined for me forever.
And the person who was the host of that pledge break later became the dean of a law school here in New York, although not the one that I went to. So I never had a chance to talk to him about ruining my off-air recording of the Five Doctors.
By talking so much about how good the Five Doctors. Oh, God, that's so meta.
No, James, you've given me a lot of your time, and I thank you for your generosity.
Sorry about
that. Thank you for all the books you've given me over the years as well. I read The Giggle in 3 days, which seems unfair because this is a book that needs to be savored. I need to go back in and find some of the acrostics you're mentioning.
Yes, thank you for reading it so quickly, and thank you for all of your time. And sorry if I've talked for too long. Please go and enjoy. See, for you it is your afternoon. For me it is bedtime. So yes, enjoy everything, Jason.
Doctor Who, The Celestial Toymaker, written by Alison Benjamin, author credit to Jerry Davis and Alison Benjamin, televised as The Celestial Toymaker, teleplay by Jerry Davis, from a script by Donald Tosh, based upon an idea by Brian Hales, screen credit to Brian Hales, televised in April 1966, paperback release date November 20th, 1986, target book number 111, cover artist Graham Potts. Somewhere outside space and time, there waits the Celestial Toymaker, an enigmatic being who ensnares unwary travelers into his domain to play out his dark and deadly games. Separated from the security of the TARDIS, the Doctor is forced to play the complex trilogic game with the evil magician. Meanwhile, Dodo and Stephen must enter into a series of tests with, among others, the schoolboy Cyril and the King and Queen of Hearts. If they lose, they are condemned to become the Toymaker's playthings for all eternity. For in the malevolent wonderland that is the Celestial Toy Room, nothing is just for fun. Reading Chapter 1 of the Celestial Toymaker novelization is a disconcerting experience. The writing is full of continuity references to past stories, most notably The Massacre and The Ark, the two TV serials which immediately preceded this on BBC One in the spring of 1966. That's good to know, except it causes problems for the less Who-obsessed reader of autumn 1986. If you lived in the US, you would have seen The Ark on PBS already, probably, if you were in the right market. That was part of the Hartnell syndication package which came to the States, at least to my area of the Northeast, a little over a year earlier.
And yes, the end of episode 4 of the arc contained the lead-in to this story, a cliffhanger preserved on page 7 of this book. But if you lived in the UK, you wouldn't have seen the arc unless you were old enough to remember March 1966, and you were even less likely to have seen or remembered the massacre. And neither of those stories had come out as novelizations yet, either, not until 1987, so you wouldn't have known them from the books. This is an odd script for an American writer, possibly not well familiar with Doctor Who, to adapt in book form, and probably not just because of the continuity references to stories that most folks would not have been familiar with. Alison Benjamin doesn't do bad prose, but she uses the word Chinese 5 times on page 13 alone, and that's going to cause problems for later critical interpretations of the serial. She does at least add modern special effects, the Toymaker's ring emitting concentric rings of blue fire on pages 15 and 20 both. The prose is pretty crisp too, page 13. Further around the room, there was a collection of mechanical clocks, some with figurines which came out and struck the hour with huge gongs, some like the ancient town clocks of medieval Germany with a series of figures led by Father Time with his scythe that paraded when the hour was struck, the whirring clicking mechanisms, the occasional cuckoo from the cuckoo clocks, and the loud ticking from the grandfather clocks produced an almost symphonic medley of sound. Chapter 2 is somewhat annoyingly called Bring On the Clowns. I would say Send In the Clowns was right there, but I imagine James Goss's music copyright clearance lawyer, had she been with the target range in 1986, would not have allowed that. The dialogue throughout the text is mostly faithful to the TV script, though the Toymaker has a much sharper edge in the TV dialogue than he does in the corresponding material in Chapter 2, while Joey and Clara the Clowns taunting Stephen and Dodo is about the same word for word. The author does very well describing the sets. There are some neat details in the chapter, like the Toymaker's desk displaying very dangerous human toys like missiles and nuclear subs. The Doctor picks up an astronaut doll who's implied to have been one of the Toymaker's unsuccessful opponents, a lost astronaut. You could headcanon that as George Clooney's character in Gravity, if you like, or Norman Jones in You Only Live Twice, which is slightly more Doctor Who adjacent. There are flashes of added characterization, too. I wonder if Jerry Davis left the author with written instructions or a series Bible of sorts, or if he edited the text before submission to Target. Some combination of that, probably. If you're an expert, let me know. The Doctor at one point is pleased when his quote, "Sometimes fallible memory worked efficiently." Dodo compares herself to Stephen on page 37. Quote, "Dodo frowned at him. She didn't like it when Stephen treated her like a child, as if she wasn't responsible. She was a good deal more responsible than he was most of the time, she thought. Stephen went for things with the single-mindedness of a bull. He was a good-hearted fellow, and would do anything for anybody. But he also caused trouble by, as the Doctor put it, bashing in, before considering the situation carefully enough." I mean, that is good characterization, though not at all borne out by the dreadful way Dodo was portrayed on TV for those 4 weeks in April 1966, and we'll come back to that. The episode 1 material runs on for 41 pages, a third of the book's length, even though it's only a fourth of the TV material. So all that time spent establishing tone and mood, especially in Chapter 3, is going to be hard to replicate with later episodes. But the second playthrough of Blind Man's Bluff, after Joey and Clara are caught out for cheating the first playthrough, works well. The room is described as going dark and cold when the cheating clowns replay the course, with Clara, as she reverts to doll form, pressing the buzzer more and more insistently and ineffectively. All this to say, the book is better than I remember, even if in style it's markedly more juvenile than Davis's solo work. Compare, for example, the Highlanders. On page 49, the Doctor tells the Toymaker that he chooses his companions, quote, "very carefully." You will not hear that line on TV, and it's not specifically accurate for those of you who believe in rigid continuity, both Stephen and Dodo having entered the TARDIS accidentally and without permission. The infamous eeny, meeny, miny, moe line falls on page 62, end of chapter 4. My understanding and my planned guest for the second episode of this book will have the definitive word, but my understanding is the script given to the actor, who went by the stage name Campbell Singer, did not spell out the entire rhyme, and that the malicious ad-lib was entirely the actor's, not the production team's. The book cuts that short. I don't know if Benjamin worked from the script or a surviving audio, but here the queen stops the king at Mo, and there's no need for the rest of the rhyme. Now, you could have weak novelizations based on great TV stories. Kinda is often discussed in such terms, even if I don't fully agree. See episode 83 of this podcast. Then you can have great novelizations even out of weaker episodes, and both James Goss and I feel that way about The Dominators, see episode 86. And hey, Fraser, what's up, buddy? But sometimes a TV story is so fundamentally broken that a book is doomed, too, because it has to adapt to that same material. Witness Dodo repeatedly trying to give the game away to the King and Queen of Hearts in the episode 2 material, The Hall of Dolls, pages 63, 64, 69, 70, and 71, all in Chapter 5, have Dodo behaving stupidly. Not Alice and Benjamin's fault, and certainly not Jackie Lane's fault, but that's the material that needed to be adopted, and it is very unfortunate. The only real change made to the Episode 2 material is that the book reverses the number of chairs in the two Hall of Dolls rooms. Probably a vestige of the original script that changed later on during production. Speaking of changes to the scripts, let's take a look at Shannon Patrick Sullivan's entry for this story in Brief History of Time Travel. Jerry Davis inherited scripts by Donald Tosh from the original proposal by Brian Hales, which itself was deemed too elaborate to produce, then with extra material added by departing producer John Wiles. It was Davis's idea to take Singer and Carmen Silvera, who had already been cast, and turn their characters into three different pairs of roles in each of the first three episodes. Davis also introduced Cyril to the mix while giving Stephen and Dodo more to do, as Hartnell, having survived the efforts to oust him during this serial and getting his contract extended, was on vacation for episodes 2 and 3, pre-recording a line of dialogue for episode 2, which, as pointed out in Running Through Corridors Volume 1, treats its chair number as a complete sentence rather than an interrupted one.
Look, they've already reached their next test.
That game? I might have known. Stephen, Dodo, take care. It's chair number.
You fool!
So this book owes much more to the Jerry Davis drafts than to whatever Hales or Tosh and Wiles had planned. I suppose that means we can also blame Jerry Davis for the portrayal of Dodo. Chapter 7 is 16 pages of slapstick comedy. Coming only 4 months after The Feast of Stephen, episode 7 of The Daleks' Master Plan, which is also slapstick comedy, the Toymaker only appears on 3 pages of Chapter 7, and even that is overstating it. He's only in 7 paragraphs out of the entire chapter total, and missing is a short TV scene from the same material, where the Toymaker goes from move 813. So there's not a whole lot of Toymaker in the Celestial Toymaker novelization. In the book, at least, Stephen and Dodo are more proactive about finding the key, actively snatching the pie from Sergeant Rugg, rather than merely picking it up after it's already been tossed onto the floor. Going with James Goss's theory, I think this chapter is where the author's will was broken by the material. Speaking of which, it's very hard to stage a dance party in print. Chapter 8 is a dance party, perhaps losing track of the fact that she's writing a generation after the TV story took place. She has the characters dance to disco music on page 98. Never minding that nobody was doing the hustle until a dozen years after this was made. Side note, my mother used to be a subscriber to Sheet Music Magazine, which actually printed an easy piano arrangement of Do the Hustle in the late 70s. I learned how to play that one, not that I remember anymore. I was confused by the lyrics to Do the Hustle, represented by X's instead of musical notes.
Jerry Davis says in the introduction that Cyril, quote, was not meant to resemble Billy Bunter, just the capacity for mischief that exists in most schoolboys. But nobody told the production crew that Cyril was not meant to resemble Billy Bunter. The character says so, as such, exactly, on TV. Let's give a listen.
Hello, remember me? I'm Cyril, known to my friends as Billy. How did that time scare you?
Yes, it did.
We've seen you before, haven't we?
That's right. You're Dodo, aren't you? And you're Stephen?
I got a shock.
You should see your face.
You'll feel my hand in a minute. What have you got there?
Be careful. I'll show you. Look.
Take the thing off.
Oh, right there.
Are there any more of these schoolboy jokes on you?
I don't know why you're carrying on like this. I'm just trying to be friendly.
That's a charming way to make friends.
Look, I'm sure he didn't mean any harm.
Of course not. Here, have some sweets.
Oh, no thanks.
Oh, go on, do.
Dodo, take them. We'll be here all day.
Have I eaten them all? I should be sick, I expect. You know, you're one of my heroes. When I grow up, I want to be just like you.
When you grow up?
Yes.
Well, you look pretty grown up to me already.
Stephen, look. Doctor's reached morgue 902.
So we'll have to hurry. Mom, where's the next game we have to play?
Yaroo! It's right over here. You won't find it so easy this time, you know. Because you see, you'll be playing against me.
Episode 4 is generally derided as a full episode's worth of characters playing hopscotch. That part of the episode only runs 10 minutes, and doesn't bother me as much as I pretend. The game does play out in better detail than some random idea, such as, oh, I don't know, drawing a card at random from a deck or playing catch. The author, however, only has 22 pages and 2 chapters to address the final episode, which means that 12 pages are playing hopscotch, which goes on for a lot longer than 10 minutes of television. The book also lacks the visual flair of the James Goss novelization of The Giggle, where the game of catch, at least, is much more entertaining in print than it may appear to be on television. Now, a shortage of pages for the final act is not unprecedented for Target. Malcolm Hulk often left himself only half of that length to cover the final part of a story. And it's not like the average Target book page count wasn't 30 pages longer than this in 1986, unless perhaps this book had to bear the shortfall to make up for Fury from the Deep's, quote, bumper length. There is one kind of nifty extra detail in the book, that Stephen and Dodo, should they lose, will become Cyril's playmates, as Cyril has become lonely. This is neat, as is the running through Carter's observation, that the King and Queen characters from Episode 2 are exactly what Stephen and Dodo would have become if they lost. The book is missing the final TV scene, a lead-in to one of my favorites, The Gunfighters. See Episode 101 of this program, another two-part episode, also starring a James, Jim Sangster. A bit odd that the book doesn't include this lead-in, as The Gunfighters had already been novelized, whereas the stories referred to in Chapter 1 had not been novelized yet. We also lose the detail of Dodo pocketing Cyril's sweets, which happened at the end of Chapter 8, and which directly sets up that final cliffhanger. But then again, most Hartnell TV serials ended with a lead-in to the next story, and almost none of the Hartnell novelizations included that lead-in, except for Terrence Dix at the end of both An Unearthly Child and The Rescue. And while this book is much better written and engaging than I remembered, it does prove, in the end, sadly, that Alison Benjamin is no Terrence Dix. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are taking a short trip and a sidestep. We are going to be looking at a non-Target book written under the Doctor Who license and published in 1986, right alongside Celestial Toymaker, and right before The Seeds of Death, which is the next novelization we will eventually come to. I'm talking about What We're Sold
in the United States as the Find Your Fate books. And we will discuss the only Find Your Fate novel that I own, written by a fellow Target author from the 1986 print run, Mr. William Ems. Joining me is going to be Tony Witt from the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, and we are going to find our fates together by choosing our own adventures with Doctor Who. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. The executive producer is David Barsky. This episode is produced by Jim Sangster and yours truly. This week's episode was written by me and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my very special guest, James Goss. Thanks again, James. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky on YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.